Usually when we think about greatness, whether it's in sports or business or art, we tend to lean on this incredibly romanticized image.
Right, the whole natural talent thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We picture this like lightning bolt of pure, unadulterated talent just striking someone at birth.
Yeah.
We really love the myth of the chosen one.
It is a comforting narrative, isn't it? I mean, if greatness is just a lottery ticket of genetics or, divine inspiration, it neatly absolves the rest of us from even trying to reach that level.
Oh, 100%. We can just sit back and say, well, I wasn't born with it, so why bother?
Right. But then you stumble into the world of legendary boxing trainer Cus D'Amato, and that lightning bolt myth just completely
It
shatters.
really does. We're diving into his archives today, and his fundamental premise is honestly jarring. He believed a human being isn't born outstanding. They're built, like literally manufactured.
Yeah, he had this fascinating metaphor about having two buttons inside you. A green button for the kind, sympathetic, normal person just navigating daily society, and a red button for the fighting machine.
And the captivating part isn't just that he thought everyone has a red button. It's that D'Amato essentially engineered this precise scientific wiring system to let a person build that red button from scratch.
And then, crucially, press it on command whenever they need it to.
Exactly. So, welcome to today's Custom Deep Dive. If you're listening to this, you're a lifelong learner. You're always looking for that potent, usable wisdom, the real signal through the noise, right?
Without drowning in endless theory.
Right. So today, our mission is to explore this unbeaten, legendary framework created by Cus. Specifically, we're unpacking two intersecting concepts, his system of creating conditions and the internal engine that powers it, called the Axis of the Champion.
Now, the system of creating conditions is, well, it's exactly what it sounds like. D'Amato didn't believe in relying on a fighter's willpower.
Because willpower depletes.
Exactly. It's a finite resource. Instead, he believed in engineering an external environment, like a set of uncompromising physical and psychological conditions where success becomes the only logical output possible.
An environment designed to force adaptation. And this methodology built unprecedented heavyweight champions like Mike Tyson at record-breaking young
Which
ages.
is wild when you think about it.
It is wild. But here's why this matters to you, listening right now. While this originates in some gritty boxing gym in the Catskills, this deep dive isn't really about fighting.
Not at all.
It's about the science of victory. It's about how you fundamentally rebuild your own character to achieve seemingly impossible results in your career, your art, or just your life.
And to understand how he forced that adaptation, we have to look inside that system at the internal blueprint, the axis of the champion.
Right, the axis.
Yeah. D'Amato approached human performance with this brutal, almost mathematical logic. The core sequence of the axis is simply character dictates result.
Okay, let's unpack this sequence because I feel like it challenges how most of us approach our goals.
It really does. D'Amato argued that if you want a massive result, you have to accept that your current character is objectively incapable of achieving it.
Right, because if your current self were capable, you'd already have the result.
Exactly. It strips away the ego entirely. It's not an insult, it's just physics. Your current character doesn't have the capacity.
So you can't just, like, try harder.
No, trying harder fails. You must build an entirely new character. And the axis maps out this chain reaction to do it. It begins with psychology.
Psychology prepares the character.
Yeah, you have to prime the psychology to clear out the baseline fears and the emotional baggage that block action. And once the mind is cleared, you introduce philosophy.
And philosophy acts as the bridge, because philosophy shapes your belief system, and crucially, it forms your will.
Precisely. Philosophy answers the why. It generates the will. And will is the engine that demands tactics.
Meaning, if your will is strong enough, it forces you to figure out how to get what you want.
Exactly. Those are your tactics. And only then do tactics dictate which specific skills you actually need to acquire.
Right. So you fuse the psychology, philosophy, will, tactics, and skills into a logical model, and boom, that secures the result.
You've got it.
I look at this chain reaction, and it perfectly explains why most people fail when they try learning something new. It reminds me of trying to upgrade a computer.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Right. Like, imagine you want to run a massive, complex piece of 3D rendering software. Those are the skills. Most people just try to download the skills directly into their brain.
But their operating system is ancient.
Yes. Their underlying psychology and philosophy is 20 years old. If you try to run heavy, modern software on a weak, outdated OS, the whole machine crashes.
You burn out.
Exactly, you quit. So DiMatteo's basically saying you have to upgrade the core processor first.
That's spot on. People will bash their heads against the wall, endlessly drilling a skill, but they haven't upgraded their internal OS to understand the tactical blueprint of when or why to use it.
Or worse, their philosophy hasn't generated the will to sustain the effort when it gets really hard.
Yeah. And there's a ruthless catch to this axis, too. It's cyclical.
Right. Achieving the result isn't the end.
Not at all. The methodology explicitly states that results are never enough.
That's so intense.
It is. Once you hit your goal, even if you literally become the heavyweight champion of the world, the axis dictates that you have to immediately set a higher benchmark.
So you look at your championship-winning character, declare it insufficient for the next mountain, and start building a new character all over again.
Which highlights just how incredibly fragile this process of rebuilding a human being actually
Oh,
is.
for sure.
Booting up a new psychological operating system requires massive energy, and more importantly, it requires zero interference.
And that brings us to the most extreme and frankly controversial component of DiMatteo's method, the crucible of temporary isolation.
Yeah, because the outside world is constantly trying to drag you back to your old character.
DiMatteo believed that to protect this newly forming will, you had to drastically alter your environment. The historical accounts describe his setup as being akin to a monastic cell.
Or joining a chivalric order, yeah.
Right. The standard protocol for his fighters was about 2.5 months of absolute total isolation from everyday society. No distractions, and crucially, isolated from family and friends.
He had a notoriously blunt view on social circles. He famously claimed that pumpkin-headed people and results are incompatible.
Pumpkin-headed people. I love that phrase.
Yeah, he demanded his fighters strictly surround themselves with people who perform.
But let's look at the psychological toll of this, for the listener. Stripping away your family and your support network, isn't that essentially cult-like isolation?
Well,
Like, does severing those social ties damage the psyche long term, or just create an unsustainable dependency on the trainer?
I mean, that is the danger if the isolation is permanent. But DiMatteo was engineering a specific temporary mechanism. It was a targeted 2.5 month sprint.
Okay, so it had a clear end date.
Yes, the goal was to break what the methodology calls I don't want deadlocks.
The deadlocks.
No.
What does that look like in practice?
Think about daily life. Every day, your environment forces you into micro compromises. You want to train, but your friend wants to grab a drink.
Right.
Your family tells you to take a break because you're working too hard. These interactions constantly trigger the neural pathways of your old character.
Ah, they act as enablers for your comfort zone.
Exactly. Isolation starves those old neural pathways. By removing the environmental triggers that force compromise, the fighter doesn't expend any willpower resisting distractions.
Because there's nothing to resist.
Right. The I don't want deadlock is broken because there is simply nothing else to do but train, eat, sleep, and absorb the new philosophy.
It's like a psychological incubator.
Yes. And once the new character hardens, they re-enter society.
So it's really about eliminating the friction of choice. I could see the application for us, even if we aren't moving to a cabin in the Catskills.
Definitely.
If I'm trying to pivot my career or write a book, I don't need to ghost my family, but I do need periods of uncompromising monastic focus where I deliberately kill the noise. I have to protect the signal.
You have to manufacture your own system of creating conditions, whatever that looks like for your life.
Okay, so let's say the conditions are set. You're isolated. Your will is locked in. Your philosophy is upgraded.
Right.
The axis now dictates that your will demands tactics and skills.
Right.
So how did Cuz engineer a way to learn these skills faster and more effectively than anyone else?
This is where his scientific obsession really shines.
Enter the Willy bag.
Yes, the Willy bag. It's a legendary piece of boxing equipment, but its origin is wild. It wasn't just a heavy bag some guy taped up in a gym.
Right. It was the culmination of 4 years of intense cross-disciplinary scientific research.
4 years.
And the consultants he brought in to design this thing, it literally sounds like a joke setup. He hired a professional shooting expert, a piano teacher, and a jockey.
I know, it sounds ridiculous, but he was hunting for universal principles of human biomechanics and neurophysiology. He didn't care about boxing tradition. He only cared about what mathematically worked.
Okay, let's break down those consultants because the mechanics are brilliant.
Sure, so from the professional shooter, he studied proprioception.
Which is spatial awareness, right?
Basically, yeah. How to acquire and hit a target instantly without consciously aiming.
Okay, and let's talk about the jockey. I read that in the notes and couldn't figure out the connection at first. How does riding a horse translate to throwing a devastating punch?
It's all about kinetic chain power and leverage. Think about what a jockey has to do. They are perched on top of a massive moving animal, right?
Yeah.
And they have to maintain a perfectly stable center of gravity while generating driving force. A jockey uses their legs, driving down into the stirrups to send force up through their hips to control their position.
Oh, wow. Okay, I see where this is going.
D'Amato realized a boxer needs to do the exact same thing. True punching power doesn't come from the arm.
It comes from the ground up.
Exactly. It comes from driving the legs into the canvas and transferring that kinetic energy up through the hips and out through the fist. He studied the jockey to perfect that ground up power transfer.
That makes total sense. And then, this is my favorite part, he brings in a piano teacher.
Right.
Which, again, seems absurd until you think about the nervous system. The piano teacher was brought in to consult on rhythm and muscle memory.
Yes.
It's like learning to type on a keyboard. Mm-hmm. When you type quickly, you aren't consciously thinking, move the left index finger to the F key.
No, of course not.
Your nervous system bypasses conscious thought entirely and just executes the word. D'Amato wanted to train a boxer's nervous system to bypass conscious thought in the ring.
And to achieve that, he designed the Willy bag. It was a pivoting bag covered with mattresses and marked with very specific numbers.
So not just blank targets.
Right. Each number corresponded to an exact anatomically vulnerable strike point on the human body. The training wasn't about just hitting it hard. The fighter would hear a number called out or see a specific angle open up as the bag pivoted.
And they had to execute complex combinations reflexively.
Instant.
And he distilled the entire history of boxing down to what he called the 7+1 strikes. He basically analyzed thousands of fights and determined there are 7 guaranteed knockout punches plus an 8th rare one.
It's essentially an alphabet of violence.
That's a great way to put it.
And the mechanics of that 8th rare punch are just fascinating. The notes describe it as a counter blow to the corpus or the body with a straight hand.
But why is it a guaranteed knockout?
It comes down to pure physiology. D'Amato calculated that if you throw a perfectly straight driving counter punch into the solar plexus or liver at the exact microsecond, your opponent is stepping in and inhaling.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you temporarily paralyze their diaphragm. It violently shuts down their autonomic nervous system.
I mean, it just completely overrides their system.
Yes. The brain sends a panic signal to the body because it suddenly can't breathe and the legs just give out. It doesn't matter how tough the opponent is. It's a biological override.
It's pure science. You isolate the person, you upgrade their operating system, and then you give them this mathematically perfect tool to download the tactics. It just removes all the delusion from the training process.
It really does. The Willy bag perfectly encapsulates his rejection of locker room wisdom. He traded that in for optimizing human performance to a mathematical certainty.
But, you know, this introduces a massive variable. You can have the best scientific tools in the world. You can have the Willy bag, the isolation, the biomechanics.
Right.
But a coach can only do so much. A tool is useless if the person won't pick it up.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most crucial mechanism of D'Amato's entire system. The whole apparatus relies completely on the individual's self-governance.
The archives refer to this as Cus's warning stage. It establishes his ultimate non-negotiable standard.
Yeah, the deeds over words standard.
Exactly. He would tell every fighter who walked through his doors, I'm going to judge you based on your deeds and not your words. I'm going to watch your deeds and not what you tell me.
And this standard created a truly paradoxical environment in his gym. The records describe it as a full reign of democracy under dominating dictatorship.
Now, how does that actually function? Because a dictatorship usually implies intense micromanagement.
That's the twist. The dictatorship was the uncompromising nature of the system of creating conditions. The rules of the gym, the isolation, the Willy bag techniques, those were absolute.
Okay, so where does the democracy come in?
The democracy lay in the execution. Nobody was ever forced to train. D'Amato wasn't going to drag you out of bed at 4 a.m. He wasn't going to hold your hand or yell at you to hit the bag.
Wow.
A fighter had to actively walk up to him and ask what to do. There are stories of D'Amato literally standing silently by the ropes for 2 hours, just watching.
Just standing there.
Just watching, maybe occasionally barking, move your head,
mm-hmm.
But he would not initiate the work.
The psychological weight of that silence must have been immense. I mean, it's brilliant reverse psychology. But as a trainer, isn't that a huge risk? You could lose your best prospect just because they had a lazy week and you refused to intervene?
It is a risk, yeah. But it's a necessary one if you understand the axis of the champion. Remember the sequence. Philosophy generates will, and will demands tactics.
Oh, I see. If D'Amato dragged a fighter out of bed or guilted them into hitting the bag, D'Amato would be supplying the will.
Exactly. He would be acting as their battery.
And the second Coast leaves the room, the battery is gone, and the fighter collapses.
You nailed it. By forcing the fighter to initiate the work every single day, against the crushing weight of that silent expectation, D'Amato proved whether their character had actually transformed.
Because if you talk endlessly about wanting to be a champion, but you don't step up to the bag on your own,
then your internal operating system haven't changed. Words are meaningless. Deeds are the only metric of will. If you didn't have the internal engine, you simply washed out of the gym.
It's an uncompromising filter for greatness. So, looking at this entire framework, how do we translate this from a boxing ring in the 80s to your life today?
The takeaways represent a really profound shift in how we view ambition.
Right. If you want to become truly formidable in your field, you have to stop obsessing over just downloading new skills. You must address the entire axis.
You have to evaluate your psychology and your philosophy first. You have to upgrade the operating system.
And you have to respect the fragility of that process. You don't necessarily need to move to a monastic cell, but you must aggressively curate your environment.
Starve the old habits.
Yes. Manufacture a space that starves your old habits and protects your focus, breaking those constant environmental compromises.
And you also need to relentlessly seek the mechanisms of how things work, rather than relying on guesswork.
Find your own willy bag.
Exactly. Find the underlying physics or biomechanics of your craft. And finally, you have to adopt the absolute standard of deeds over words.
Stop telling people what you are going to do
and
simply force your actions to align with your ambitions. You have to be your own battery.
It is a ruthless, beautifully logical system for peak performance, but it does leave us with a bit of a provocative dilemma.
It really does. It goes back to the cyclical nature of the axis we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The system dictates that results are never enough.
Right. The moment you achieve the goal, the blueprint demands that you tear down that character, set a higher benchmark, and start the grueling cycle all over again.
So if you fundamentally train your psychology to view every single victory, no matter how massive, as merely the baseline for the next grueling mountain, the question becomes, is there ever a finish line?
Yeah. Do you eventually run out of mountains to climb? Or does the constant striving, the perpetual dissatisfaction, become the only reality your brain can process?
Think back to the green button, the red button D'Amato talked about. The green button for the normal, peaceful person, and the red button for the fighting machine. If you spend your entire life continually upgrading and pressing the red button to conquer the next peak, you have to wonder if the green one ever really works the same way again.
Can you build a machine designed solely for war and ever expect it to know how to be at peace?
Something to mull over the next time you set a massive goal. Until next time, keep diving deep.